Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm your host, Sandy Fowler, and I want to thank Acree.com for sponsoring the show. Acree, E-C-R-E-E is the way you spell that. They are an on-demand writing tutor for our kids. So they have our backs when it comes to teaching our kids to write. Today, we have your back in understanding the opioid epidemic. This is something that is impacting families across the country, and it is impacting families regardless of race, religious beliefs, socioeconomic background. I know in episode 61, we interviewed Jamie Dalton. She's an incredible young woman. I met her at a conference, and she became addicted to opioids after dislocating her knee in college, and she received a prescription for painkillers. She did not get clear directions and thought that she needed to take 2 Vicodin every 4 hours, in spite of the fact that the pills actually made her feel terrible and nauseous. But she thought it was like an antibiotic where you had to take it for it to help her heal. So when she stopped taking them, she experienced many uncomfortable symptoms and her knee hurt again. So she took another dose and all of the symptoms went away, and that was it. That's when she knew she was addicted. Our Mighty Parenting co-founder's son, Jeffrey Davis, he shares his story of becoming addicted to drugs and alcohol. And his story also involved a doctor's prescription for a pain reliever after breaking a bone. He was young at the time. I'm thinking he was about 8 years old. I could be a little off on that, but when Judy tells us the story, she says what she remembers is Jeffrey's comment after taking the first pill. And he went, "Wow, Mom, all the pain is gone." And Judy was happy because she'd been watching her child suffer with this broken bone. What she didn't understand at the time is that, yes, he meant the physical pain, but even more than that, he was commenting on the emotional pain he'd been experiencing that his parents didn't even understand at the time. And it's experiences like this that make us so passionate about helping families understand what's happening and how it can affect them, how it can affect you. So we want you to know that. We want you to know what's happening. We want you to know how to protect yourself and others. To that end, we have Sam Quiñones with us today. Sam is the author of the book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opioid Epidemic. Sam is a journalist, he's an author and a storyteller. And the adult edition of his book Dreamland won the MBCC Award for General Nonfiction. Now he's written a version for teens, and he is joining us today so we can discuss what's happening in our country and what we can do about it. Sam, thank you so much for joining us to chat today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I've already said these words, I don't know how many times in this opening, opioid epidemic. We see it splashed all around the news these days. But what does that really mean? What is really happening with our kids and in our communities?
Well, I think it generally speaking refers to a widespread coast to coast, really, problem with addiction to narcotic painkillers. That's the beginning of it all. But then as time has gone on, that was a few years ago, increasingly you've seen people get addicted from those pills to have switched to heroin. The underworld has figured out that a better substitute for heroin is a drug called fentanyl, which is actually a legitimate painkiller used in surgeries, but used by the underworld, it becomes intensely lethal. And so they've supplanted heroin now with fentanyl, and that's killing. That's one reason why the death toll is so high nowadays. And lately, I think drug traffickers have been supplanting even that with methamphetamine, which is a whole other story. But basically, I think what has happened is that we have due to massive and relentless, I would say, prescribing of narcotic painkillers for many, many years, beginning in the middle 1990s. We saw, a lot of people dealt with pain that way. A lot of people, however, got addicted to those same painkillers because they all are all derived from eventually the opium poppy, like heroin, like codeine, like a variety of other drugs we know. And these drugs were one part of this epidemic, I think, is greatly due to the fact that there was no care taken in who got these pills, that they were essentially prescribed by doctors to a wide swath of people without ever asking them anything about their background. Did they have addiction in their background, alcoholism? Do they use drugs themselves? And so you've got lots of people caught up in that who probably should have been weeded out, should never have been getting these drugs, and eventually got addicted. On top of that, you had this idea that this begins with this idea that these pills are virtually non-addictive when used to treat pain. This is an idea promoted by pain specialists and then later by pharmaceutical companies and adopted by med schools and so on, that you could not get addicted if you were in pain. And so the idea gained credence. And what ended up happening was doctors began to prescribe these drugs for long periods of time, particularly after surgeries when there was maybe 3 days worth of pain. You got 30 days worth of pills, maybe another refill after that. And you had this enormous new supply of narcotic painkillers sloshing around the country from coast to coast. And a lot of that helped addict people and lead to the situation we're in now, which is the deadliest drug scourge in the history of the country. And that is generally speaking what is referred to as the opioid crisis. There's more to it, but that's kind of in a nutshell.
And reading your book, I was absolutely fascinated with all these different pieces of the situation.
Yes.
Was not aware of everything that was going on. I probably driving my family crazy, especially my two daughters. I have two daughters in their 20s. And I keep right. reading pieces and going, oh my gosh, did you know this? This is just, to me, appalling. Number one, is you talked about the doctors who took advantage of the situation and were just prescribing. They were peddling drugs. They were not being medical professionals. Right. They were being drug dealers who got rich off of the established medical and pharmaceutical system.
Right. No, I'd say that's part of the story. Indeed, what I realized when I got into this was that this was a multifaceted story. It was not one thread storyline through it all. It was many threads. You could not tell it with just one way or just one town. You needed to be in a variety of areas, and you need to understand that, yes, this was a doctor's, but I will say this about doctors. It's important to understand this. First of all, it's important to understand that this is the first drug scourge, let's say, that we've had that did not start with drug mafias, street peddlers, the underworld. It starts with doctors. But I also want to say this about doctors. Doctors, indeed, all across the country bought into this idea that they could prescribe these pills for almost anybody on almost any pain situation with almost no risk. But they were also pushed. There were a lot of pressures on doctors. They had to get patients through. Managed care meant they had 12, 13 minutes for a patient. They did not have a lot of time to discuss with patients why these pills were probably not a good idea for some patients. They also were confronting a lot of patients, us, as Americans. You know, we bear a certain amount of responsibility in all this. We, generally speaking, as a culture now, began to demand that doctors fix us, that demand quick solutions to our pain. We didn't want to hear when the doctor said, oh, by the way, part of your chronic pain might be that you're overweight, you don't get enough exercise, you eat poor foods, you smoke, you drink, a variety of things that require us as health consumers to change how we consume, how we behave. A lot of Americans just did not want to hear that, and doctors felt that very, very up close and personal. And so there were a lot of pressures on docs and to change, to adopt this. A lot of them did not want to do it, still had to go along with it because they got pressured by a variety of pressures, financial, legal pressures as well. So it's a complicated story. There is no one villain. I think the search for one villain in the story will lead you down the wrong path. In fact, it's a complicated story. The doctors who did get rich on these things, they were on the outskirts. They were like these kind of quack docs who may have started, you know, fairly sincerely trying to help people's pain and just got addicted to the money and the amount of patients they never had to fill their waiting room. Their waiting rooms were always full because of people looking for drugs. But there's a lot more to the story. And I think also it's very important to understand that a lot of it has to do with us as American health consumers.
And I love that you directed it there, because that is the piece that we as parents can do something about. If right. there is something going on, quote unquote, out there in the world, yes, you know, we do what we can at Mighty Parenting. We always focus on, okay, what can we do at home? But we can have a large impact within our own family and in our own home, starting with, like you said, taking some responsibility for it. I wrote down a quote because I thought this was so powerful from your book. You said, "This is the story of the agony we create in the search for a pain-free life." And to me,
right.
that sums it up. You know, a big part of many problems that we have in our culture are because somehow we've cultivated an idea that life should never have sorrow or difficulty or physical or emotional pain in it. And yeah, that was
I heard you talking about. Right. No, I have to say that I believe that to be a big part of this story. We hovered over our kids, afraid that they'd skin their knees outside. You know, it's this kind of bubble wrapping of children so that they feel not just pain, but then disappointment. I would say one of the things that to me struck me early on was the number of people getting addicted to pills and then heroin after having their wisdom teeth extracted. And this was this avoidance of pain is a big part of that, because parents frequently accompany their kids into these dental appointments, and they made sure that the dentist prescribed a lot of these pills because they didn't want their kid feeling any pain after, you know, this kind of thing. The number of kids who have died of heroin overdoses that began an addiction began with wisdom tooth extraction and enormous amounts of pills prescribed after that wisdom tooth extraction is just mind-boggling. It's a very, very sad part of this story. And I think a big part of it is we as parents, as American parents, got into the habit of not wanting our kids to feel any pain. And then that became not just physical pain, but then kind of emotional pain. And then it became just disappointment. God forbid we be the only parent on our block to not give our kid an $800 smartphone. You know, God forbid that kid not feel that disappointment. Oh my gosh, that would be a terrible thing, you know. So to me, this is all, it gets into a much deeper story than I initially thought. I thought this story was about pharmaceutical salesmen and marketing and on one hand, and heroin traffickers on the other. And then as I got into it, I began to realize, you know, this is really about our inability to desire to avoid all pain, as if we could actually never have any pain in our lives. And then also, I think a big part of it too is our destruction of community. So we're so isolated in America today that it leaves us very vulnerable. And these are the most isolating drugs we know.
Oh, that's an interesting point there, is the isolation. And it's another thing that as parents we feel as our kids grow. When they're very young, well, first when they're babies and toddlers, we just seek out places that we can get together with other parents, and you have to drive your kids. So you're waiting and you talk to people. And when they're very little, you're discussing milestones and things like that. But as our kids become tweens and then teens, and then they move out, we feel more isolated. And we also feel isolated by that pressure, like you talked about, being the only parents who aren't doing this or the only parents who require that. And that I think can also contribute to our desire to reduce our children's pain when something does happen. I want to go back to the wisdom story for just a minute, because this was something that I noticed when we took my daughter in. I was already more sensitive to this because Judy's son, Jeffrey, I have permission to share their story. Jeffrey is part of our company. We started by sharing the Davis family and their journey of Jeffrey's drug and alcohol addiction and suicide attempts. So I have permission to share it. But because of being good friends with Judy and knowing about all of this, I was already more tuned in, more aware of drugs and medications. And my oldest daughter is just averse to taking any kinds of painkillers, just over the counter. She doesn't like them, doesn't like the way they make her feel. So when she had her wisdom teeth out and we were leaving, it was a Friday afternoon, and there was this pack of, I don't even remember, it was at least 10 pills, if not the 30. I don't think it was the 30 days. I think it was enough for like 10 days. But that was still, we didn't expect to use any. We didn't want any. I didn't want them in the house if we didn't need them and all of that. And so I asked, could we just get one or two? And they're like, no, you have to take all 10. And fortunately, being in a world where I discuss these kinds of things, I was aware that I could say, no, thank you. Give me a prescription. And I went to my pharmacist and said, can you just give me one or two in case we need it tonight? And then we can come get more from you tomorrow morning. And they can do that. So I want parents to be aware that you have those choices, that you, even when someone says, hey, this is our system, you can ask questions and voice your desire and say, how can I work with you within your system or the larger system, but not take all these medications? Is there something we can take that is not opioid? You know, my daughter did Tylenol and ice, and yes, she was uncomfortable, but she wasn't writhing in pain.
Right. And I think that's the key thing here, that we have this idea that we must be pain-free, zero pain. And the truth is that has never been the case in the history of humanity. We're the only culture, last 25 years in America, the only time, I believe, where an entire culture more or less adopted the idea that pain-free life was actually possible and a good thing. And I think we want no pain. And I think doctors, pharmaceutical companies, medical schools got used to the idea that Americans were demanding no pain at all. And so it was constant drumbeat. Are you in any pain? Do hospitals get judged on how well you answer the question? Did your doctor address your pain? This kind of thing. We got this drumbeat going on that. And I think that is definitely the backdrop to this whole thing. You got found people, you know, I've sprained both my ankles three times each, playing basketball since I was in high school and after that. And everybody knows how to deal with a sprained ankle. You go home, you put your ankle up for 4 days, you put some ice on it, maybe a little bit of swelling, like ibuprofen or something, and you just wait. You just let nature take its course. But so often we're in this idea like no pain at all is the standard. And I think, frankly, I think the medical establishment, doctors and pharmaceutical companies figured that out, began to respond to it, began to market to it. And a big part of what happened there was the consequences of that marketing that, you know, anything to keep your kid from feeling pain, anything from you to feel pain, which is not to say that pain is not real or that we can just gut out every kind of pain there is. That's not true. Sometimes these pills have very, very great uses in medicine within very limited windows and controlled very, very well. But the problem is that we got into the idea that because we now viewed them as virtually non-addictive, which is an erroneous view, that we could send vast bottles of the stuff home with everybody who came through the door. And that was the real, I would say downfall. This was the real source of this problem initially. Again, it's morphed since then. But if you go back and look at most heroin addicts, you go to counseling sessions or AA groups or NA groups, and you ask people how they got started, they almost every one of them got started through a pill that was prescribed. Some of them were getting pills prescribed themselves for a car accident or athletic injury, what have you. Others were buying pills off the street, but almost all of those pills were prescribed to somebody. It was an excess, an explosion of excessive supply that took place over 20 plus years.
Well, and that was one of the things your book did for me, is it helped me understand these different facets. It helped me understand better what was going on. So I also, again, feel better equipped to speak to my doctors. And before, when I would speak to our doctors, I didn't always get a very helpful response, but reading your book, I understand why now. In there, you talked about they were taught in medical school, they were told by the pharmaceutical reps that those pills were not addictive and could not be addictive. And so now I can understand better where they're coming from. So I feel like that gave me a better foundation to come from to talk to them. And I again wanted to share with parents. So just, we don't want to harp too much on the one specific point, but it worries me because we trust our doctors. The doctors are trusting the people who taught them and trained them. And what we are now finding out, or have known now for a while, but is still traveling through all the information loops, is that you said 30 of every 100 users of opiates will abuse them. That's 3 out of 10. You know, I just look at one of my girls in their circle of friends. It's like, there are 10 kids there, You know, and to think that 3 of mm-hmm. them can end up abusing them and 12 out of every 100 becomes fully addicted. And the idea of what happens with these pills. So I was actually wanting to go next because you talked about them showing up through our medical visits, through especially the wisdom teeth thing, because as patients, as parents, as clients, we have pushed our doctors to make us pain-free. They have set up systems to help us do that because these are regulated medications, so they have to have systems. That's why my oral surgeon couldn't just give us 1 or 2 pills, because that wasn't part of their system. Now I understand it better. Yeah. But another place that you said that pills are very prevalent is athletic locker rooms. And
yeah,
again, I think that's a thing that really throws parents, because you think, oh, my kid's involved in sports. This is a great thing. This is the kind of thing that helps keep them out of trouble. And not that it's bad. I'm not saying don't have them in sports, but I think I'd like to talk about this a little. So again, we aren't going around with blinders on as parents. So what's right. going well, on I in would the say athletic that, locker room?
I mean, I think this may be modifying today to some degree, but for many years, pain comes with certain athletic, particularly football, lacrosse, soccer, wrestling, powerlifting, et cetera, these kinds of sports, often baseball. You get injuries, shoulders, hips, what have you, knees. And the approach was take these pills because these pills are now known to be virtually non-addictive if you're in pain. And the problem is with these pills is also that the longer you take them, the much higher risk occurs of being addicted. And so people would take them through a season to get through a football season, and by the end of the season be pretty well on their way, if not fully addicted to some major addiction. There was an acceptance of these by the doctors, by the training staff, by the coaches, by the parents, and by the players, because this was just the conventional wisdom. I'll say this too, that those pills played into the desires of every one of those people, because the desire of the player is to get back on the field, because nobody wants to, if you're in a football season, nobody wants to miss 8 weeks of the season, even though that might be what your injury would really require. The pills allow you to get back right back on the field next week or 2 weeks later. Of course, it plays into frequently what the parents want. The parents want their kids out there playing. They see that the kids love it. Sometimes, frankly, a lot of parents derive an enormous amount of ego boost and pride from how the fact that their kids are out there playing. It's something to boast about on the golf course, or at the cocktail parties about what your kid's doing and this kind of thing. And so the parents want those kids. Maybe there's a college scholarship in the offing, perhaps. I would say that the coaches and trainers, same thing. They want their kid out there playing because that kid is a talented athlete. And so you began to see in the athletic world a lot of this. And it dawned on me that football, all-American sport, you know, big men on campus, football was really the gateway to heroin addiction in a lot of high school and college and high schools and colleges. It's just because of the way we decided we could treat pain with no risk from pills that really derive from the opium poppy, which is one of the oldest drugs we know as a species. We know that they're addictive. We know they're great painkillers, but we know they're also addictive. We decided that only one of those was true. They're great painkillers, but now they're non-addictive. And so I would say, too, that there's a larger point to be made about sports in America today when it comes to this. It dawned on me as I began to understand the connection to the destruction of community in America as a root, definitely one of the main roots of this problem. And sports used to be a part of how we created community, right? You'd have little league games and all parents would get together, right? You'd have a high school football game and everyone's together. Well, now sports have become, especially for younger kids, almost like a combine. You get these club sports in which kids are practicing 5-6 days a week or 5 days a week, and then they travel, but they travel far, far away. And they can't, nobody from the community can actually participate and go out to those games because they're 50 miles away. It requires the entire family to participate. And it also does another crucial thing. It keeps kids who might develop later from actually being competitive. So you cannot go out for your soccer team anymore if you have not already spent 6 years, by the time you're a junior in high school, let's say, if you have not already spent 5, 6, 7 years in a club team, you cannot go out. So you leave a lot of people on the sidelines who cannot compete because we have this combine, this ferocious, intense, obsessive idea that we have to create professional athletes out of 12-year-olds. And it's hockey, it's soccer, it's basketball, volleyball, et cetera, and it has a very damaging effect on the beauty that sports actually play in creating a community feel, because nobody really is going to these games. It's just about the parents and the kid anymore, and sometimes, of course, there's an enormous amount of investment in big athletic facilities and so on, just for these kids. And what it does is really keeps it kind of maims the ability of the community to come together around sports. It's a very big deal that's going on right now, I think, in sports that really deprives an area of the community benefits of sports, which I played basketball all through 7th through 12th grade, and I clearly see those benefits. They're undoubtable, and you cannot deny them. But they have been, people have been deprived of them because of this approach to sports. It's like a combine, a kind of a ferocious transformation of 12-year-olds into pro, semi-pro athletes or something.
Well, and it seems like that would also add to the pressure on the parents, the players, the coaches, everybody to get these kids back on the field or in the pool or, you know, whatever it is that their sport is, when, especially on something like a travel team, you have limited number of kids and there's just a lot of pressure there. The other thing I think that has happened with, I was thinking about this with the athletes, and we talked about the idea of kids getting overprescribed for certain situations. So then you have these pills floating around, and you talked about in your book the idea of, you know, pills showing up at parties. I know it was 8 or 10 years ago when my friends' older kids first started going off to college, and I'm hearing about how the dorm rooms in where, you know, we just had parties and brave souls might get some underage people out, you know, might get some underage beer drinking going on or something. Whereas now it was just bowls of pills that kids were taking. Can you share more about what's going on with that, I guess, social culture around.
Absolutely. What began to happen as we began to see this expansion of supply, more and more doctors all across the country prescribing more and more pills, is that all across the country, medicine cabinets all across the country began to contain these pills. And parents were not aware that they needed to keep those things under lock and key. You do not leave those things in the medicine cabinet ever. That kind of thing. That people weren't aware of the damage that these could do. And a lot of kids began to swipe them. You began to see workers swipe on them when they would work on a person's house. So what began to happen is an enormous supply of legitimately, so to speak, prescribed pills began to also create an enormous black market. They were out there to be abused or diverted. And the black market you began to see pop up in every region in the country. You could get by these pills then eventually on the street because the supply was so vast and so unrelenting year after year. And so in most areas, it was a dollar a milligram. So you're buying an 80 milligram OxyContin, it's going to cost you $80. For a lot of kids, though, in high school, their parents had this stuff. So they bring it to the – so it began to supplant – you know, the typical thing I always heard was, you know, when we were growing up, we'd drink beer and smoke pot around a bonfire, and pretty soon it just became pills. No more. Yeah, some beer, but no more. Yeah, basically, it was just all pills, and that's another way in which people got addicted. It was not that they were prescribed those specific pills, but those pills were so plentifully and relentlessly prescribed by doctors all across the country that they naturally leaked out into the high school scene or the college scene, whatever it happened to be, and therefore very easily then created new problems of addiction for a huge number of people all across the country, even though they were not the ones who had been prescribed those pills.
And the other piece was for whether the kids were actually prescribed themselves or they were given or bought them from someone else who was prescribed them, was this idea of the time release. And I'm sure you'll explain that better than I can. But again, in Jeffrey's case, he had a prescription for an ADHD med, but he started snorting it instead of taking the pill. And so he was snorting it to actually get high off of it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think what they began to figure out, particularly as their addiction began to advance or their abuse began to advance, is that one pill in particular, OxyContin, was a time-released pill. And so that meant that the pill you take once in the morning and it would release the painkiller, oxycodone, a well-known long-time opioid painkiller. It would release that through your body over the next, well, supposedly 12 hours. Turns out maybe less than that, but that's a whole other story. That was the way it was supposed to be taken. But then as time went on, people understood that these pills, that OxyContin was not like the other opioids that had been prescribed. The other opioids had been prescribed before, Vicodin, Percocet, Lortab, various other ones, all contained acetaminophen. So if you took the pill and abused the pill over time, it would do enormous damage to your internal organs. And people just didn't do it that much. Some people did, but the numbers were fairly limited because you would do an enormous amount of damage to your liver and your kidney and so on with the acetaminophen that was in very high doses in these pills. So it was really to keep people from abusing it that the acetaminophen was out. Well, OxyContin contained no acetaminophen, no real abuse deterrent for the first 14 years of its life. And so people learned very quickly that in order, when they wanted a bigger rush, when the tolerance developed, they wanted a bigger rush, that they could just lick off the time-release coating, suck off the time-release coating, crush up the pill, smoke the pill, and then eventually, of course, when smoking it wasn't enough, they turned to shooting it, like injecting it. And that was the story of OxyContin. It came in large doses with no abuse deterrent, unlike Vicodin and Percocet and some of the others. It did not have any abuse deterrent. And so it was 40 milligrams, it was 80 milligrams. For a while, they sold a pill that was 160 milligrams. That was a couple of years, and they stopped that. But people would take these pills and understand there was a big whack of dope in each pill, and they would disarm, so to speak, the time-release mechanism and first snort it, but then eventually begin to shoot it. And once they began to shoot it, that's when heroin came into the picture, because people began to realize, you know what, this is costing me a dollar a milligram. I'm using 4 Oxy-80s a day. That's 320 a day. That's 320 bucks a day. I cannot sustain that. And along comes very, very cheap, very potent Mexican heroin. And it's a no-brainer, so to speak, that people switch to heroin after you're spending hundreds of dollars a day on the pills. You just can't sustain that, and you begin to switch to heroin. That's where we begin to see lots of people becoming who were pill addicts transitioning to become heroin addicts.
So I'm kind of thinking back through the things we've talked about and going, all right, so, you know, as a parent, are there things I'm doing that add to this, things that I could be contributing to the problem? And I think we've already talked about that a little bit, and that's the not questioning the medical system when we need medication of any kind, not knowing or following through on if we have narcotic prescriptions in our house, keeping them locked up and not just going under the, well, my kids are good kids. Even if your kids are good kids, I have many stories of very good kids who've become addicted. And once you're addicted, you will do whatever. Or like you said, workers, other kids coming through, whatever. And then I lost the third one that I was going to say. But it's the being aware that some pain in our life is okay. I'm not saying seek it out. We don't want to go there either. But try to work on this concept that we have that we can't have any amount of pain in our life. And yes, use these medications when needed, when appropriate. So after I go, okay, here's what's going on and kind of what I'm doing, what can I do to protect my kids is my next thought. And I know you talk to a lot of people, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are, parents of teens, 20-somethings, and younger kids as well, and even for ourselves, because anybody can get addicted to these. What are some of the other preventative measures that we could be taking for ourselves and for our families?
Well, I think those are good ones. I mean, the main one is not to have pills in the house at all. I mean, or under the most limited circumstances, of course, under lock and key. But again, if a wisdom tooth extraction, I'm not a dentist, but I think if you talk to dentists today, they will say, yeah, you don't need those pills. You need some ibuprofen, and you need to be willing to let your kid be in some discomfort for 2 days. Yeah, well, that's not a high price to pay, considering what is possible if you choose the other route. So I think a lot of discussion with the doctor over why this is necessary is really, really important. I would say too that if in the sad result that someone does get addicted, you become aware very quickly of that is happening. Sometimes you see the friends change, like all of a sudden these very healthy friendships they have are replaced by people you kind of don't know, or they don't look very savory. It does help. It helps enormously to be out in the community talking. Everybody, there's a party. You don't ever let a party happen without of high school students, without parents being there, more than just the parents who own the house, aware of what's going on. Very quickly talking to kids about who may be dealing in their area, because this is about supply. You don't have the supply, you don't have the problem, really. And so if you have a dealer in your area, you need to get on that immediately. And people know, the kids know this is what's going on. I would say that paying very close attention to who your child is calling on cell phones, huge thing. Normally, by the time that person, your kid is addicted, most of the contacts on that cell phone will have some drug connection. It'll be who he gets dope from, who he uses dope with, et cetera, on that. You're not paying attention. If you're not revising, it has to be a part of every parent's modus operandi to constantly be reviewing. Okay, who are you texting? Who are you talking to? Who are you emailing? Who are you, whatever social media app the child uses, you need to be all over that. I personally believe My daughter's the only 13-year-old in her friend group who does not have a smartphone, okay? That these are highly addictive instruments, and they allow for even more addiction to take place. And you see it over and over and, oh, it's just a constant that you need to pay attention. If you're going to give your kid a smartphone, you better make part of that the understanding that you are going to check that smartphone every 2 days. You're going to check it for who the person's calling, who your child's calling, why, that kind of thing. Who's this person? What's that about? Who's that on Instagram? All these kinds of things. To me, it requires an activism in parenting that some parents are loath to engage in because they feel like, well, I'm infringing on my child's freedom. I'm like, well, first of all, the child wouldn't have that freedom if you didn't buy a $1,000 smartphone for them. You know, so it's your money that's creating this. You need to then watch out because smartphones allow for modern day drug trafficking to take place. It's just an absolute truth. And so I would say that paying a lot of attention to that kind of stuff is really, really important. Otherwise, you are abdicating your role as parent and understanding the most important word a parent can say to a child is no. No, you can't do this. No, you can't have that app. No, I'm going to block you on this from this time to that time. This gives the child also an out. You know, the child says, I can't be doing this because my parents are going to check. I can't be involved in this because my mom's going to be checking. That is the best way to avoid. That's one of the great ways of avoiding getting involved in this in the first place, seems to me.
I've always told our kids, in fact, my girls are in their 20s, and we had a conversation recently where I said, feel free to use us as the excuse. My parents won't let me go out that late. They are insisting on keeping, you know, my girls are in their 20s and they don't have their own cars yet. So they're reliant on us. You know, my mom insisted that I have her car home by this time, whatever. We've always done that. The other thing that I see is a great tool. Well, first of all, I'm going to put a couple of episodes of our shows in the show notes, because as you were talking, we had a show on social media. We had a show on smartphones with Danny Kim just recently. We had a show with Alvin Gonzalez from our local court system about kids getting in trouble that touch on some of the things you talked about as well and expand on that. So we'll put those in the show notes for anyone who wants to listen to that. But the other piece is the conversations and teaching our kids what is really going on, what the real dangers are. And that's one of the things that I love about you having this book written for teens is that, one, they can read it. Always recommend to their high school teachers that maybe, you know, that might be appropriate for one of their classes, or you can read it as a family. Or like in my case, I'm the only one who's actually reading it, but I just keep bringing it up in conversation, partly because it's fascinating to me and partly because I want my girls to know. And sometimes I just drop a fact and go, oh my gosh, did you know this? I had no idea. And then other times I try to prompt a little more and go, well, what do you think about that? What would you do in that situation? How would you, if you're at a party and this is what's going on, how would you get out of there? And let them think it through and come up with ideas and then support them in some brainstorming so that they've thought through some of these things ahead of time. And so that they know if they're playing sports and they're injured, it's going to hurt, and that is okay. Not that we want you to be in horrifying pain. That's not it. But to just start those conversations and start that thought process that you
and
want.
That was very, very important. All of that is very, very important. You have to have that. Can I say one thing? That was one of the main reasons we produced this young adult version of Dreamland. I began at speeches I would give around the country about the original book. I would begin to encounter parents who were saying, you know, do you have anything more for like 10th graders, say, which probably the original Dreamland may not, maybe a bit advanced for say a typical 10th grader. So, and began to also get some feedback from teachers who use the book in their class. For a lot of teachers, the original book worked very, very well, but there was some younger grades that maybe not so well. And so the idea was to open this up because I saw a lot of kids coming up, and while they might have been around it like in their daily lives, they didn't seem to have a clear idea of the dangers or why it got going or what, you know, and it also provided, I think, definitely has been the feedback that has provided a perfect way of discussing what is a tough conversation to have. And I would say that this is a huge thing to achieve as a parent. You got to have those conversations. It's got to be not one, though. It's kind of like it's got to be a constant, you know, like you're always talking about it. The other thing I think that is enormously important is we have seen in the last 20 years has been called the golden age of neuroscience research. The tools that we have to understand and to see the brain under the influence of certain substances or feelings, the way we have of scanning the brain, the functional magnetic resonance imaging, it's just astounding. Just astounding to see what a brain looks like on high potency marijuana, for example. I mean, it's such a powerful tool. And I think parents might be well served to look these images up on online. You can find a lot of them. You can find a lot of stuff on YouTube or in various websites about this kind of thing. And use that too. The most powerful anti-drug message I ever heard, I was on a panel with a neuroscientist from Johns Hopkins, great university in Baltimore. And I didn't even know. After a while, I didn't even know why I'm on the panel. I was just enthralled with what this woman was saying. And the slides that she was showing, such a powerful demonstration of how your brain is just totally captive and corroded, too, at times, by the substances that people the kids put in their bodies. And I think that particularly early on, part of a health science unit in say 10th or 11th grade, maybe something like that, could be enormously powerful using those images, because brain science and brain research has leapt forward in the last 20, 25 years with the technology we now have. I would greatly urge your listeners to check that out and use that when they discuss some of this stuff. It's so powerful, and it's I think really worthy of use in any kind of family discussion.
So I'm going to date myself here and say, so we're not looking at pictures of eggs in a frying pan anymore, huh?
No more. It is vivid, multicolored images of what your brain looks like when you are on. I mean, you know, there are ways of scanning the brain when your brain is on storytelling, when your brain is on caffeine, when your brain is just in a normal state without any kind of maybe stimulant, and then when your brain is on marijuana, when your brain is on cocaine, what this does to the prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that is right by your behind your forehead, that really governs all of our more mature decision making, planning, executive function. That is the last part of our brain to develop, and to think that kids are still not having that part of their brain developed and yet they're getting blasted by opioids in various forms or high potency marijuana is a scary, scary thing to behold.
Yeah. And that's just we're not going to go down that rabbit hole, and we've touched on it before in an episode, but again, a reminder, marijuana is not what it was 15 or 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. So be aware of that.
Certainly not.
And if that's something that caught your interest that you didn't know, look into that a little bit, or pop us an email and we'll point you in the direction of a little bit of info on that. And so I think this is a really a great conversation. It's an important one to have. And I want to encourage everyone who's listening to share this conversation with other parents, other people in your life. And so hitting on just, you know, a few of the high points is that there is an opioid epidemic in this country, that it is all across the U.S. It does not discriminate. And it came about from many different causes, including honest doctors with bad information, including doctors who got sucked into their own addictions or their own need to make a lot of money, including our desire to live pain-free. And so we need to take responsibility now and make sure that we are being aware and conscious of the medications in our lives or when someone wants to bring something into our life. Remember, I'm going to go with this quote, and that is, this is the story of the agony we create in search for a pain-free life. So as a mom, I know what that's like. If you've been listening for a while, you know my daughter broke her foot this summer, and it was the worst 3 days of my life while she was away from home, and we were sorting everything out and figuring out if it was actually broken and she hurt. And it is, it's terrible. But a quote like that can help remind us what the consequences can be if we're not willing to walk through a little bit of pain. And be careful of isolation. That was an unexpected note from you, Sam, that I think is really important to watch out for isolation. And then as far as our kids are concerned, some of the common places that they end up on opioids for legitimate reasons or for social reasons, but it can start with a medical visit, particularly the wisdom teeth getting pulled, particularly our athletes, and then again, social situations. Kids aren't just going to a college party and having a few beers anymore or a high school party and doing some underage drinking. It's a lot more focused on pills. They don't know what they're taking. They don't know what that is. And they just don't understand what it does to them. So it's our job to have conversations. And your book, Dreamland, Sam, is, I think, a great tool for doing that. We will, of course, have a link to it in our show notes. But for anyone who wants to see more about you or find you, where can they get to you online?
They can go to my website, which is samquinones.com, and that's samquinones.com, samquinones.com. I'm on Facebook, Sam Quinones Journalist. I'm on Twitter, samquinones7. And these books are available. Dreamland is available both in the original and on the young adult version on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other book websites. Very easy to find. Shouldn't be too hard.
Great. And Mighty Parents, thank you for being here today. If you're enjoying the podcast, then I invite you to join our Mighty Parenting Facebook group too. I'm thinking this week we'll do a live on living a life with pain, talking a little bit about why we'd want to do that. What does that mean? What tools do we have? So thanks for being here, and I will see you next week.